Is there a remote or something? No? Just here? Terus-terusan.
Sampai
ganti sorean atau?
Sore gak apa-apa.
Apa sih?
After office hour. Like after 4. Or maybe I was at work before the course. But it's only 1 hour.
I mean, the next time anyway, that will be 25th. No, 1 is today. Because I have yeah, next time that will be 25th. I will have a big deadline anyway, so I'll be crazy that day. So maybe we should cancel that anyway.
So I think for the next meeting is like weekly, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, like the next one is 25th.
Meeting is like on the next Tuesday.
Yeah, so that's 25th. That's when I'm not functioning the whole day.
I'm just like, 25th is like also like one of the craziest time because like there will be a next time in the next week.
Yeah. And then 26th until 29th, I won't be here. Maybe that week we just kind of like hand in each our progress online, like written report. No? Let's see. How does this work? This doesn't work. Wait, do I have to? Oh, there you go. That just takes forever. Okay. That's fine then. I'll eat later.
Yeah. usually we have 2 times 45 minutes or sometimes in one row.
Yeah.
So it's up to you how you want to convey your content.
Because I think I have, last year also, like I have like a chunk that is like, more or less, and then break, and then...
Okay, good. It's just to let you know.
Yeah.
So you decide
how
to...
And it's usually 15 minutes, right? Break.
Yeah, or 10 minutes or 15. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ini nama section gimana ya?
Nama section apa?
Ini apa? Aku mau taruh
F section.
Astagfirullah. Thank you.
Peter, do I have to wear this?
No.
No. Okay.
Just
this.
Just this.
Okay.
Yeah. you're back again. 52nd lecture today is related to texture analysis of digital images. I'm happy to have Hilda here again. Have you met the first cohort?
No. One or two, like, during the... Okay. Yeah. Well, you.
So, you can maybe just tell a little bit about you.
Yeah.
You came also once as a CNET.
Yes, person. Yes, I did.
Okay. Floor is yours.
Thank you. So, yeah, my name is Hilda Deborah. I was one of the CMAT student. That was 10 years ago. So, yeah, I'm a dinosaur. So I'm originally from Indonesia, and then I did my undergrad in computer science over there, and then I came for CMAT. I was first in Saint-Étienne and then Granada, and then my whole second year was here. Yeah, and then my PhD was again a type of traveling around. It was between here and then France. And then I did a postdoc that was here in Iceland. Now I'm here as a senior researcher. I'm done with that traveling life. It's, you know, you can't have stuff when you travel around so much like that. So it's finally now, if I go to IKEA or like other places, I know that I can have stuff because, you know, it's not just like two suitcases. What's the limit of what I can have? My talk today, this is about texture analysis. You've seen stuff from Fereste, mostly on perception. Here, remove everything about perception. This has no connection on, like, what we see or, like, what we think we see. Some will have, like, a relationship to that, but this is purely how... And this is not including deep learning. Whatever goes with that, because that just like gives you stuff automatically. Here I'm trying to make sense of how computer used to do it. So that's my attempt. You'll see this type of images. I like to use, so these backgrounds are not, it's not actually paintings, but if you see this type of background, that's from Mars. That's my fascination. I nerd about texture.
So when you were there?
2 years ago. Yeah. Outline of what you'll get today is definition. You'll see that it's a bit all over the place. And then I'll tell you about the existing approaches. Again, this is excluding deep learning approaches. And then I will also tell you, because like texture analysis is like one framework. It's not just like one type of thing. And then I'll give you example applications. But here, what I aim to tell you today is basically conceptually, so you can grasp it. And then also the examples are not, you know, one of those like very complicated things that goes for, I don't know, this algorithm and that algorithm, and so it's. I'm trying to make you understand conceptually what it is. So the first one is, what is texture definition? I'm going to make a scope here that I'm talking only about optical texture, visual stuff. So nothing that is tactile, nothing that we touch. And then also, I don't talk about texture in other type of imaging. So, and there is like MRI and then seismic sections that they also talk about texture there, but I'm not touching that. Here, it's really just optical, visual, and then like think about color cameras or hyperspectral too. Now, even from the beginning, it already says this. No formal definition of texture exists. Because part of it is like, when we see it, we know, but it's hard to pinpoint. But anyway, intuitively, this descriptor provides measures of properties such as smoothness, coarseness and regularity, and I'll show you some examples of images that, that fits with that. Another person in another book says that texture is the variation of data at scales smaller than the scales of interest. I will also show you images where this would make sense. The third definition that I picked was that texture is the characteristic physical structure given to an object by the size, the shape, the arrangement, and the proportions of its parts. So all this definition is valid because, well, let's see later. First definition. So the thing that we can compute here from this definition is smoothness, coarseness, and regularity. Where's my mouse? Here. Here, we know that the surface of whatever this is, that's smooth, right? And then we have coarse texture, which corresponds to, well, we think it's rough. Here I'm still, when I'm talking about these things, I'm still talking about kind of my perception, my sensing of things. So this is not yet going to computers, right? And then we have regular, where usually in regular texture, you have stuff repeating and you see the regularity. You see the pattern of it repeating. On the second definition, texture is the variation of data at scale smaller than the one we're interested at in. So for example, in typical computer vision tasks, object recognition, scene understanding, those things are, what they care about is really the objects, right? But then we have texture, which gets in the way, usually. Because, like, for example, on that first image of bananas, if, like, a typical thing that you want to do with this type of images is counting. Us as human, we can do that, because we know where is the edges, where are the edges of each individual banana, and we can do counting, no problem. But then when we put this in into, I don't know, edge detection first, if it's object counting, we have to do that. And edge detection first, this will not work because we have the texture, which is basically everywhere inside the object, and that is of scale smaller than the object of interest. But we need to deal with that, right? And that's texture. On this, the person image here, also we have texture, which is of scale less than the human, which we are interested in, but it is in the way. So we have to deal with that. And here also, if we're trying to recognize, let's say, okay, look, give me the object of the lemons, and then my algorithm knows that it should be a circle. It should be uniformly yellow, but it's not because there's like something going on with one part of the skin. That's texture too. Yeah. So here, generally, one interest with texture, why you need to care for that is actually because you want to get rid of that, because it gets in the way of your object recognition or scene understanding. Now, here with this definition, it gets more interesting because it's not just stuff that you want to get rid of. We have size, we have shape, we have arrangement and proportions. So I don't remember actually what this image of. Maybe some landscape somewhere. But it's geological structure. And if I'm asked to kind of, as someone that is not an expert in geology, if I'm told to, like, please, like, segment these areas into, like, areas that you think are different landscape, I would, like, have three. This is, like, one line over here and another line over here, just based on kind of, like, my experience of, like, how landscapes are. But then again, this, putting this into like a simple object recognition, yeah, good luck with that, will not work. And then when it comes to like size and then the arrangement, then we also have problems like various types of grains, counting, or kind of like in just food industry. Shape-wise, it's about the same. It's like ellipse, like these grains. But then they have different sizes, and then you're giving different typing based on the sizes. Let's say we remove the color. And then this is a more difficult case where I actually don't know what to do with this. But this is texture, and this is types of remote sensing of images. Here, texture is important because then you want to check, okay, this area is arid, dry, and whatever, and that's based on the texture of this area, is vegetation, you care about that because A, B, C, and D, and all that. But yeah, so we still cannot, and people still cannot pinpoint exactly what texture is, but what we know from texture is that we can measure smoothness or coarseness or regularity, and then what is really relevant when we have texture is basically the arrangement of stuff, element in it, that varies in size, in shape, and then also how it's structurally placed in an image. That is something that computers can, algorithms can compute. How to deal with that? This is also a big area of research. Here I'm really just talking about grayscale images. I'm not going into colors because it's let alone spectral, because there we have different problem. I'll give you an overview of the existing approaches for extracting texture features. That doesn't cover everything, of course. And I'll give you some explanation of the simpler ones. So you start to grasp how we actually compute texture size, how do we actually compute shape, and how do we actually compute like these different things, how are they arranged, how we can compute that. So, as I mentioned, texture analysis is a framework. So it's not one algorithm or two algorithms or one approach. It's a framework. I'm assuming you've already learned image processing, but there, most likely, the inherent assumption is that surfaces that we're dealing with are uniform. Not really. Because, I mean, like, in reality, and, like, for example, I have to work with remote sensing a lot. There is no uniformity in there. Because also, like, even here, well, with man-made objects like this, I see the texture here. I can assume some uniformity over here. But things in nature, it's not like that. So, for example, here, these are man-made objects, machine-made objects. We don't have that difficulty because our assumption that surfaces are uniform, that's fine here. That works. And then if I just kind of like put it in for doing edge detection, that's my edges. That checks out. It's fine, right? It's the glasses, the sunglasses, it has like the edge around it, although it has some other stuff in the middle also, but in general, this is okay. Because when we assume uniformity in an image, that is basically, in terms of pixel values, you have some type of distribution, but probably it's normal distribution. So if you assume that, and then you go around the image and trying to basically catch where the edges are, well, it's quite easy, right? Because, okay, my assumption, the pixel value should be within this distribution. When it's not, there's an edge. So that works because specifically, edge is defined as abrupt and local changes in intensity. So outside that distribution, that's abrupt. here's another one example where it doesn't work. Because if we just assume that an object is where the distributions are uniform, we have all these different things as the edges. When actually with task like this, what I would like to do is having an edge here and then here. So it's not any more edges where, like, edges of objects, but it's edges of texture. So here, the relevant question is actually, I don't want to identify the individual object, but I want to identify where things start being, like, different texture, and then if I put that in, like, normal edge detection, it doesn't work. So now is actually when we start to have to thinking that objects are non-uniform, and only then we can start looking at texture. Here's the different stuff, again, excluding deep learning. Part of it is it's a bunch of different stuff. Part of it is because we have different definitions and different algorithms, different approaches, look at different definition and try to tackle from that point of view. So we have statistical ways of looking at things, histogram, because like distribution of stuff. And then also like what I said before, if it's outside this distribution, out, that's statistical, right? And then it can also look at the structural placement of things. There's model-based, there's also transform-based. But don't worry, I'm just going to talk about this simpler stuff today. Yes, so two stuff from statistical. I hope that will be simple enough. And then one structural. What time is it? So the first one, oh, well, so far, questions. It's okay? And also in general, like, anything unclear, raise your hand and just, like, interrupt me. First approach for the statistical, in the statistical approach is doing histogram. It's, I'm assuming you know what histogram is, right? Yes, nodding. So first, the first image is smooth, the second image is coarse, the third image is regular, because we know that there's like this element that is repeating, and we know that it's regular in the repeat. So with histogram properties, first we compute the histogram. I think it's imhist on MATLAB, and then we get that, and from there we can compute different things from the histogram. So it's not the histogram itself. We have to do like a second step. We can compute the mean, the standard deviation, the R value, third moment, which is skewness. That is also helpful sometimes. We can also compute like uniformity and entropy. And all these things tells you about different things texture aspect-wise. So, first one, standard deviation. Again, we have these three images, and can we actually tell whether one is smooth, one is coarse, one is regular, based on just the standard deviation? That's the formula. You can just like code that. But that's the histogram that I get from each images. The smooth histogram, the smooth image, that is uniform around the center, right? So then from here we know, well, if my image is smooth, the standard deviation should be narrow. Actually, it doesn't really matter maybe where it is in the histogram, but as long as it's narrow, I know that the pixels are not that different from each other. Doesn't matter if it's dark, doesn't matter if it's like in the middle or bright, but if it's narrow, I know it's smooth. I know that the image is smooth. So for this, standard deviation is probably enough, right? if I have a coarse image, we see that the pixels are distributed quite evenly from like 0 to 255, and we have this different peaks. And okay, that checks out with what we see, right? But then it starts being challenging, probably, when we need to compare coarse and regular. Because, yeah, on the regular one, we don't see two peaks, but this is just in this particular image. And then I would start to have doubts whether standard deviation would be enough for differentiating between coarse and regular texture. But then, okay, let's say I can add this other variable that I can compute from the histogram, uniformity. Still easy for smooth because, we see that it's with like smooth surface, smooth image, it's uniform, so it should be narrow in the uniformity coefficient. So it's narrow, but it means it's high in uniformity, right? When I put in the coarse and the regular, they are much lower in terms of uniformity. So it's telling me, well, okay, this is not uniform at all. Yeah, that checks out. But then apparently if I use this to compare coarse and regular, in general, regular texture have higher uniformity, because again, it, you know, we have elements that repeats in a way that we can quantify. I'm sorry if you're allergic to this equations and stuff, but for now, forget the equation. But what concurrence matrix is, it's actually histogram, but for a pair of points. So the normal histogram is you are counting how many pixel value 1 are there, how many pixel value 50 are there. Here, what you do is actually, if I find 1 here and I find 50 in the other place, how many that pair of like 1 and 50 I get. So concurrence matrix is basically histogram of pair of points. In that way, it's two-dimensional because you have two variables. And this is just how you compute it, basically. But conceptually, it's just that. So concurrence matrix, or GLCM, that's like one of the most famous texture analysis algorithm. It is not fast, because basically in computing this histogram, you have to decide how you're looking at the pair of points in terms of distance. How many distance are you covering? Am I looking at pair of points in like 5 pixel distance, 10, or do I add more? And you're also looking at direct rotation. So I'm looking at 5 in that direction, but that direction too, that direction too. The more combination you compute, of course, you get more sensitive and to some extent get more accurate, right? But that takes forever. So this is not fun. And also this is just in grayscale, right? How are you treating colors? Like, what kind of pairs do I look here? So this is one of the most popular, the most used and whatnot, but it takes forever. I guess this will be just like an exercise that you can do later at home, because now you know the concept like of how to compute this concurrence matrix, and this is what you will get in the end. But later at home, this is your pixel values
try to check if you can get the same thing as this one. If you decide, okay, I want to look at this distance and then this orientation. Yep. Question so far? It's okay, right? So first we looked at histogram, and then we looked at GLCM, which now you know is still histogram, but of pair of points. Those are two example of like statistical ways of computing texture. Now we're going to structural. So the issue with the statistical ways of computing texture, you know the distribution and all that, but you actually don't know where things happen spatially, right? You're blind to that. What you know is really like how many, how's the distribution, where's the trend, and things like that. But if you are given that histogram, and let's say you're asked to, well, okay, show me the images. Based on those histograms, you can't really even begin to like sketch how your image would look like, because you don't know this distribution of image, where does that happen in your image. But in most cases, that is what is important about texture, right? Where in the image these things happen. So here's where a structural approach would be interesting, because basically what structural approach does is you have a structuring element or like a small window going around the image and then looking for things. Morphological operations is one of the basic ones. It is probably safe to say that this is actually at the bottom of almost, you know, like everything in image processing, because, well, yeah. Now, the first one is erosion. I'm not sure if you've heard of erosion and deletion. That's in morphology. So if we have this structure with like these two objects, and then we have this structuring element with this as a center and this size, erosion, what it does is basically it's going around the image and eroding the islands with this size. So what you get at the end is basically smaller islands. And trying to differentiate that from deletion is basically with erosion, you're trying to see where B fits I, as in the entire thing fits the element. If not, remove that part. With deletion, it's for everywhere B hits I, you add the region as big as the B. So then in the end, with deletion, you connect the two islands. That's the general effect that you see. Now, yeah, in reality, because this is like I'm talking conceptually, in reality, basically, you have this structuring element, you go around, and then what you do replace or add to it is like with erosion, you are doing minimum. So because like you have a window, right? What is the minimum between like 1, 2, 3, blah, blah, blah? You replace that with that. With deletion, you're doing the maximum. So if you are thinking about set operation, deletion is intersection and then you're having a union. If erosion, then you have intersection operation. That's in set set theory. We have deletion and we have erosion, and if we build that combine, we have opening and closing. This is all, like, I always confuse myself which one goes first. So basically, you're combining it with like erosion and deletion, or deletion and erosion first. I always confuse myself about the name, but you have that here. The effect with opening is... So this is erosion first. So the effect with opening is... because you have this spiky thing as the original image. With erosion, that will be removed, right? Because it's smaller than this thing, than the structuring element. So that will be removed, and then you will get basically this just purple area. And then you delete that again. That's opening. So then you will get the original structure without the noise. So this is good for removing noise, because anything smaller than the structuring element, that will be removing the first parts of erosion, and then you want to, you know, get the structure of the image back. So yeah, this is good for removing noise in that sense. Closing, on the other hand, I'm confused about my image. Oh yeah, this is good because you are deleting things first. So if you have a hole that is smaller than your structuring element, that will be filled when you do deletion first. And then if you want to return the structure, well, that hole is filled. When you erode again, the structuring element will not detect a hole there, so that hole still keep being filled. So this is like for hole filling. In reality, if you have grayscale images, and you want to do opening and closing, you will have to try first which one actually remove the object that you don't want to be there, because sometimes noise is white. Does that mean hole filling? Does that mean noise removal? So it you have to see if your noise is white or your noise is dark. Now, I mentioned about structuring element, because that is actually one of the most important part in doing morphology. The standard one, we just use circular. It's a disc. But if, let's say, like for example, in my cases, I have patches that are square. If I do this morphological operation with a circle, I will make the edges of my square like smooth, and then it's kind of... oval, something like that. But if I want to preserve that corner, I should use something else that has also corner in the shape. So it's square then. And then if, for example, in my image, what I want to remove or what I want, what I'm interested in are elongated structures, like lines, then I don't use a square, because all my lines will be removed. Instead, I use a line, and which direction, right? So this is an important thing to decide in whatever, you know, solution you're thinking of. This has to come first, because in a lot of cases, disc or circular is used, and that's okay. But when it comes to texture, then you have to start thinking about different things. One thing that is, when I figured it out, it was actually quite annoying, is that it is not trivial to approximate what a circle looks like, right? Because we have digital. So like, if in reality it's just like that and it's smooth, but since it's digital with this corner things, how do you decide that? In Python, it looks like this always, that you have like one little thing at the top or like the ends. It's not really a circle. But it is actually MATLAB that does a better approximation of what a circle is. So if, let's say, you are computing something with morphology, just like try simple things, deletion or erosion. The same image, one you do it with Python, one you do it with MATLAB. Because in the beginning I thought, this should be exactly the same. Like, how difficult would this be? And then I get to the bottom of it, it's partly their approximation is not the same. Yeah. There's a little bit of human story behind that as well, but that's beside the point. I digress. So now if you are doing mathematical morphology, the shape or the size of your structuring element, you can think of it two ways. You design it based on the things that are relevant in the image, thus you want to keep it, or you design it based on the things that you want to remove. For example, if, let's say, I have small noises, then, well, I know exactly what those are, then I design my structuring element catering to those. Basically, well, it can be whatever, but probably circular is good, but bigger than my noises. So then, at the end, I have them removed. But, for example, well, not this one. So, with things like crack detection, basically detecting lines, elongated structure like that, I'm actually designing, in that point of view, I want to remove the cracks first, and then at the end, the things that are removed are actually the things I want to look at. So then I remove things first, but then I retrieve it back. So it's a little bit of like, with this morphology, it's a bit of like playing with Lego. You have different components and then you decide what do you want to make, really. It's not a one-fits-all solution because you have to put your creativity and like analysis into it as well. So another thing that is fun with morphology, so you see deletion, erosion, and then opening, closing, building on that. The whole morphology is basically like that. You're building with stuff. With granulometry, so basically this is like what I talked about. This was actually made, this framework, like mathematical morphology, was actually made to help people in the mines, mining, to count for stuff. So with granulometry, basically, you have, this is not really good illustration, but that was what I could find. So you have a sift, and you have, I don't know, sand or, I don't know, I've never been in the mine, gold or whatever. And then, depending on the size of your sift, you do that, and there's stuff you retain, there's stuff you discard down there. So basically, you increase the size of your sift, and then you know each time how much are things retained, how much are things discarded. So that's basically what granulometry is. So I have this target input first, and then I do opening with one size. This is size 3. And then I have the residual. This is the things that are maintained in the sift. And then I increase the size. This is the things that I retain. You keep doing that, and then you get this. So here's like a zero structuring element. You have both sides. Basically, this tells us, as in the mining, the distribution of the size of our particles in whatever, this mountain of sand. And this is also one way of telling exactly what size of grains you have, what types of the size of the elements in your image, and you have this distribution. That's that. This is so I've told you. Oh, that's perfect timing. In this part, I told you two things on statistical approaches for texture analysis. One, just simply using histogram, and then you compute the histogram, and then you compute standard deviation, uniformity, or whatever based on that histogram. And then coherence metrics, which, again, that's also just histogram, but of pair of points, which is why it takes longer to compute the histogram, because you have to decide... Well, practically, it's more like, how long can I be bothered to wait for this thing to finish, right? It's a trade-off between, like, how sensitive your histogram is to what things are happening over there, but also how sensitive you are in, you know, now I'm bored. Now I'm, I don't know, I'd rather do something else. So there's always this trade-off. And then structural, where you basically start to look at an image on the plane it's in, not just the histogram, and then start to look where things are, filling holes, checking distribution of size and shape and things like that. So yeah, we can have a break, I guess. And yeah, this is next one. How long is it, Peter? Until...
10 past 2, is that okay?
Yeah. Okay, we'll be back 10 past 2. Now I can eat. Thank you.
course, then it depends on the there's no point using that data space for that.
Provide whatever we can, and then we'll leave it to the CMM, so that we will see.
just blindly using it. Like we create the...
That is what, yes. So he has already received a number of CMMs or at least he got some contact people who promised.
I think I am gonna, but I
Should we start? Should we start again? I just realized that actually the image here that I see is actually much nicer than that one. But what was I expecting?
Perhaps you can reduce the...
The... Not boys, but lights. Oh, yeah.
Better?
Yeah. At least start seeing something. It's not that important.
Yeah, it is.
Right. Okay. I've had my coffee, so hopefully this will be okay. So I told you about Watt's texture. Even though we didn't have a precise definition that everyone adheres to, I told you about how to analyze texture, but maybe this one should come in the beginning. Why do we even bother at all, right? Do we have to deal with it? Can we ignore it? We can. But so basically, like, where's the line and blah, blah, blah. And then also I'm going to also tell you texture analysis tasks because it generally can be divided into, you know, like you have a problem. Do you do classification of texture? Do you do segmentation? Or do you do different things? Now, can we ignore texture? I'm... honestly quite practical. If I can ignore it, I will ignore it. But we actually have three cases. We have these three different images. Let's say we're doing face recognition or like tracking, even though I'm not fond of that task at all. But let's imagine this thing because it's also quite popular in computer vision. So in the first image, we have a non-textured background, and it's just a black shirt. We can assume uniformity, there being smooth, so the standard deviation and whatnot. So we can assume that here, okay, if we have something uniform, we can ignore texture. Because, well, except for the beard, I guess, this will work out. In the second case, we have textured background, but in the area where there's a human, it's fine. It's non-uniform because the t-shirt is just like, it's generally, you can assume that as uniform. Then you start kind of like, it may be ignored, the texture in the background, because it's irrelevant. But here's this kind of like gray line. What do you do with the texture? In reality, in the nature, this is what you get. You have textured background, you have textured everything. Then you have to actually deal with the texture and... then you have to start accounting for another assumption where surfaces are not uniform. So we cannot use the simple assumption of like normal distribution or uniform distribution and so on.
But that's basically, let's say, the frame, like the mindset that you go into like a different application. First, you analyze what should I do with these textures. And then you would go into different tasks in terms of categories of how you would actually do things. And the first one, and the easiest texture analysis task usually is classification. So we have this 10 images, each telling different grains. So, for example, in this case,
yeah,
it's like, I don't know. I don't know what these grains are. Let's just say I want a class for rice, and then I want a class for lentils, and those different things. Or if, let's say, I'm just like, I don't care, that's an expert task to assign class one into what grain, then I just like... This is class 1, 2, 3, and 4. But basically, the gist is, with classification, you just want to be able to differentiate between things. So the general steps is you compute the features, the structural, statistical, those like are some of the ways you can do that. And then you have to actually... because having features is one thing. How you put that into data, that's another different issue. And that's where you actually have to decide how you make the texture descriptor. And then once you have your feature in, let's say, I don't know, like a one long vector or however you decide for that, then because classification is... basically, it comes down to, like, I have this. Is that different from this? How similar is that thing from here? Then this thing of, like, being able to tell, is this similar? Is this different? You just pick a similarity or distance function that can deal with texture. Because, I mean, there's Euclidean distance, there's, I don't know, Manhattan distance and all that. But also, because, like, conceptually, it sounds like, well, yeah, it's just like that. It's just 1 plus 1 is 2. But actually, depending on how you decide to represent your data, your descriptor, that will, to some extent, tells whether you can use this function or that function as a similarity or not. So, for example, here, identification and classification of food grains. There's a reference to that paper if you want to read it. Here, how they decide to do the, okay, what will be my features and whatnot, they do coherence metrics. And, well, with this one, actually, I think it completely makes sense because coherence metrics, again, is like a pair of points, right? Mm-hmm. And then if you decide that you're, because like with, deciding where the distance is when you're looking for this pair of points, you will get back a histogram of certain peaks, and then your decision of the distance, that actually tells you the size of the grain, right? Because if you only look for, let's say, I don't know, one distance, let's say like 5 pixels, and let's just assume this is 5 pixels, and the rest is a bit big, then you have a perfect representation for this one. But actually, the rest would be just kind of like a jumble of things that I don't know what the difference are. But they are above that distance. I have like this one big histogram over there. But then if you add your distance in the GLCM, then you start actually having steps. And then you start to see, well... okay, I have these grains that have this peak in the GLCM over here with, like, smaller distance. I have one that's on, like, on the bigger distance and so on and so forth. And then how they actually, what they actually used was homogeneity, contrast, correlation, and entropy, and local homogeneity. This is, again, like the 1D histogram, where you have uniformity and whatnot coefficient. Here also, with coherence matrix, you compute in the second step different, coefficient based on this histogram. And then the coefficient, depending on how you compute it, then you tell different things. If it's the contrast in the image, if it's the correlation, if it's entropy, amount of information, and local homogeneity properties. After that, then they just use minimum distance classifier. I didn't actually go into the details on how they put the threshold. This is one class, because I mean, in classification, you have to put that threshold, right? But that's what they decided. A more, I would say, maybe it's more, it adds more complexity to the problem of texture analysis, is doing segmentation, because with classification, conceptually, what you want to get is just this: is it different? Is it similar? That's it. You don't really care where it is in the image, because usually you get different images anyway, and you want to classify these pool of images. That's one class. I don't care what it is, but it's one class. And these pool of images, they're different from these pool of images. I don't care what they are; they're different. Done. End of the story, because that's what classification is. But with segmentation, then usually it's more complicated, because you have one image and then you want to tell where things are and put basically labels of areas. This is this, this is that, this is that. In like a normal segmentation problem, what you do, and what usually is sufficient, is first you have an input image, and then you have edge detection. And then you have this edge image. There's also this thing called region detection. I can't remember the name now. Like region growing, you start in one seed and then going around that seed, telling, is this the same region? If the distribution is the same, then it is the same region, and then you start growing that region. That's one thing in region detection. And then you combine the two, because now you have edge image, the map for where the edges are, and then you have this that gives you the region. You combine that, then you have your output image, where basically things are segmented into different area. Now, simple edge detection wouldn't work. And in terms of, let's say, segmentation problem, usually in the beginning we want to test first if, like, a stupid case like this. I mean, like, for us human, this is obvious. This is like four patches, right? So when we want to test our algorithms, usually this is what we do with segmentation. We just put things equally, but we know they are different, so it's easy to compute to get the ground truth, and then we just like input that to whatever we decide to do. With edge detection, obviously this is not going to work, the simple one, because we have micro edges. It doesn't matter if you use Sobel or, like, is it Kenny that is a bit more sensitive? You're not going to get it. So one strategy with this one is, let's smooth things out. So you blur everything. Hopefully, then after, because then you remove these things that potentially become the micro edges, right? Hopefully then we will get these segments of like four different areas. not really. So here, they, so after the smoothing, what they did is they had a model, which is an assumption of the distribution of color in each patch, and it's quite okay. Like the first one here, they are assuming Gaussian behavior of color, close to uniform, like normal distribution. Then you see that for this patch, it's not actually Gaussian, it's not uniform distribution, it's very texture. It fails, right? When they use this model, kernel density estimator, I don't know exactly what they're doing, then it starts making sense. With this type of results, usually for texture, this is good enough because you have the four main areas despite like the dots where it's unrecognized where things are, but this is okay. Yep. Increasing in terms of difficulty is synthesis. Synthesis is basically you have this one image and then you want to generate texture based on that. That still looks okay. Because, I mean, if let's say I want to do synthesis just by tiling things, okay, that's probably a synthesis, but me as human would be able to tell. You're just tiling things. You're not actually making like a bigger texture that is looking like, in reality, it would be like that. So this is actually stuff that deep learning would do good on, because the idea is that you give like the training and then generate something that looks like it. I mean, that's what deep learning are good at, right? But in general, with texture synthesis is that these different algorithms are good at regular texture, but it starts having difficulties when the texture are, I don't know, all over the place. So this like synthesis, this is good for, I don't know, first thought it's just fun, second it's for inpainting. Inpainting is a problem where you have an area that, I don't know, it's gone. You don't have data for here, but like you have around there, then you want to fill this out with something, hopefully something that makes sense. And then basically you're looking around or the whole images and then check in this image, how is the statistics? How is this hole likely to be filled? So that's what texture synthesis are good for. This is actually, I don't know. I don't know if this is a made-up problem for computer vision. Maybe not. Because sometimes there are tasks that are perfect for computer vision, algorithm, and whatever, but actually in reality we don't need that. I'm not sure about this. So it's called shape from texture. You have an image, flat, and then from that you're guessing the geometry in 3D. I don't know how they did that, but they did. Looks awesome, but I probably shouldn't say this, but it's a bit whatever. It's my ignorance really, like where this is used for, but basically that's that. You have an image and then you have non-uniformity, you have, I don't know, papers that are crumpled and whatever, and you're trying to guess the 3D geometry from that.
For depth estimation?
Hmm?
For depth estimation?
Could be, yeah. Yeah. That's that. And, example use of histogram. Well, this is my own work, so I can tell more about this. Hopefully I haven't forgotten. So this is remember the use of histogram, simple, right? Here, we were trying to detect defects from hyperspectral images, and this original image looks like toy example. I mean, it's clearly is like 1, 2, 3, 4 areas. It's actually from physical pigment patch, so you have this different texture in it and things like that because of the printing process of the pigment. And even though it looks like a toy problem that should be super easy, in reality it's not. But with this one, the idea is because we have hundreds of these things and we notice that the printing process is actually not perfect, should you sell the parts that is actually or just like recall that back? So I was just thinking, well, this should be easy with histogram because we have these four areas, and to some extent, because we know the behavior of the pigments, we can assume a certain kind of distribution of the colors, and then anything that departs from that, that's a defect in the production. But because this is spectral, how do you compute the histogram, right? So actually the intermediate step was I went into a space, which is a distant space, how different things are from like a reference point. So then in that way, I have something that looks like a grayscale image, and it's easy to compute the histogram from that, right? Because it's just one dimensional. I have a difference of 5, difference of 6, difference of like 200, but in general, then I have this histogram, which is one dimensional. And then what I did was really just computing the standard deviation and putting that threshold, which is basically just an empirical law, that basically things, like everything that is outside 3 standard deviation, that's a defect. That's exactly it. That's the only thing that I did. And then you get all the defects in the image. But one thing was, I think, part of like why this worked so nicely was, I think in general, when you do image processing or computer vision solution, you need to know what is your data, what is your problem, and a big portion of getting the solution is actually there, where you spend a lot of time understanding your data, and then in the end, the solution is just like this. Granulometry. This is also a spectral. This was data from my colleague who spent, I don't know how long he spent in the basement. It was Harris in the basement, like taking pictures of stone, of like fabrics, of like, I don't know, let's just get tea or whatever and making data set out of it. I was like, well, nice that you do that. I don't have to. And then also here, actually, there was no actual problem, let's say, from like industry or something like that, but I needed to check whether my development works, and this was like a perfect example, because granulometry is for discriminating grain sizes. So then I saw these images and like, well, I should get something out of this. Like how big is it?
Yeah,
it sucks. The only thing I remember with coffee beans was that there was this company that was marketing their spectral. And now it was in the bunker room, and then they had a demo, and I came late. Okay. But then when I came in, there was smell of coffee, and I was just like, ooh, that smells of coffee, who's brewing one? That was, I wasn't supposed to do that because it was, their lighting was so bad that it burns the coffee. But it was but it was just like an honest observation. I wanted coffee. So maybe it was from that. Yeah. But yeah, there was this thing, and then I wanted to check with things that are relatively easy, because we know that the grains are, well, this is of certain size, this is of certain size, and then bigger, but then it's not digital squares. How would that work in this type of things that still look simple enough? So what you can see here, pepper, where's pepper? That one. And then milk coffee and then chili. So with milk coffee and then chili, how you interpret this is basically you don't have an obvious peak of this size is clearly there, because it's almost uniform here in the chili and milk coffee, right? So like things are quite flat. In the, for example, pepper, then you have like a peak over here. Oh, I don't put the size here, but you have a peak on certain size. So that tells kind of like this size, which is smaller, I don't remember what it exactly was, is actually quite dominant in the image. And then you have other sizes, but it's not the dominant distribution of grains over there. But that's the interpretation. It's not that intuitive looking at this different graphs, but just kind of like to show you.
It looks more like cones and rods distribution.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's true. We're sensitive towards coffee, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I am. actually, that's it. That's all I have. And so we've learned what is texture, the definition. We've learned how to do it. I show you a few different approaches. And then what's it for? We have simple examples over there. That basically also allows us to see, in terms of difficulty, the easiest one, we go from classification, and then it gets more complex with segmentation and then synthesis. I'm almost tempted to just like, you just give it to machine learning and then we're done with it. And then shape from texture. So if you are looking, and if you're doing, let's say, literature review, and you decide on texture, for example, it can be really overwhelming, because this research is a bit much. But then if you decide on doing something with this, then pinpoint like a specific thing. Let's say I'm just doing literature review on texture classification. Then anytime you have papers that is like synthesis, that is actually outside of your scope. Because the thing with texture research is that it's everywhere, it's big, and then you can touch on like papers that is actually dealing with tactile, not relevant for you. You can actually get into papers that are more in human vision, because it's like perception of texture, and then it's like low-level vision and neuroscience and all that stuff. Probably irrelevant. So my advice, if you're doing anything texture, is like first go as small as possible, because it just starts getting overwhelming really quick, and then it's hard to find what is the connection between one paper to the other if you haven't spent years in the research, I would say. So yeah, that's it.
Yes.
Thank you.
I think that was a very good advice for some of you guys who I know who are interested to do a literature review on texture.
No.
Texture classification.
Yeah.
Other questions?
I'm going to ask, you mentioned several times.
there's a lot of research with machine learning and deep learning on texture, but probably a part of it is also personal preference and the practicality, because a lot of my applications are in paintings, cultural heritage. There's nothing to train these things for, and then also I do a lot of things in spectral image. So first, you are already just having like one painting. Yes, for example, for Munch, there's like four of the Scream painting, but it's all different, and then it's spectral. Training data-wise is not there. And with these things, in general, when you go to like more dimensions in terms of your data, actually you get more information that you don't have to go complicated with your algorithm. Because, I mean, the data is already good. Yeah.
Yes, I think it's a very good question. I think you asked Tereshe before.
And I think in terms of like texture, lately I've just been looking into perception more, also in terms of cognitive science also. Like, you know, like deep learning and whatnot is solving a lot of problems, right? But let's say integration of that to actually how people work, especially medical, for example, that is really challenging because of, if something bad happens, who's going to take responsibility? Right? So the way I see it is that unless we can explain how this works, then it's hard to actually go to this field.
And there are lots of problems with...
Yeah. So it's, but it's, you know, problems in research, problems means future sometimes, because you have things to solve. Yeah.
It's interesting to discuss that area and looking at the CovaLab and the CovaLab members and what the different colleagues are doing in terms of gathering data and who is actually using deep learning techniques for the data. It's actually not so many except from Ahmed Mohi.
Yeah, medical usually. No, because one example was there was a student that was doing a lot of different things and then training his own network, and then at some point he came to me for like cultural heritage stuff. Didn't work because, I mean, there's no training data, right? It's yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
We meet again on Friday, quarter past one, with spectral reproduction, BRDF, and slightly introduction to ICC Max, if time permits. And then the second part on Friday is online with Makidis on HDR.
One lecture is offline.
Yeah, because my kid is in the US. Yeah.
And we will be here on that lecture.
Yes, so we start quarter past one physical, and then the quarter past three is online.
There's going to be like roughly a 45-minute break between the two sessions, or are they one after another?
Yeah, basically the guys. Looking at the time plan, it's 15 minutes break.
Okay, yeah.
Quarter past one to three, but dependent on the length of the interaction and discussion, it might be finish on time or it will be finished earlier. And then I made an appointment with Makidis quarter past three online. So it's up to you. You can be here or you can be everywhere. there is no weekend before 5 o'clock. You know what I mean? Okay. Good. We talk.
Do I need to give you the slides? Do I need to give you the slides? Yeah, yeah, okay. PPT is okay, right? Because then starts, there is animation, and if I make it PDF, PowerPoint, yeah, yeah. You want to get coffee?
Yes.
We can do that in the cafeteria or something.
But for some cases, you cannot like somehow
because then you need a kind of
but
object.
Here if you have just one baby,
if you have objects,
yes.
Then there's no.
However, I
yeah.
heard that people
because
kind of like augment Firefox images
so then
only
you
from
you
one
kind of
original image to generate a
partially
data set
glossy
right.
type of objects.
Crazy.
Then with different viewing angles, then the question would also be. The experiment set up, the observer, the lighting and
light of our picture.
Yeah. It depends what the expectations are, or whether you're going to choose, just two or three different angles and not multiple angles, for a coursework. Because you don't do a master project.
Yes.
It's just a short time. But have a talk with Tom Sima. She did a lot of measurements also in Germany. And actually, I'm not sure that she has conducted some.
I think that like these are the other filters and transforms.
Do you remember that he said,
but
like, I'm waiting to tell you all about the transfer and then take the exam? So there are transfers.
Have you had a book already on kind of literature or whether you found some literature? Also color differences related to the DLDF
that is
definitely a good starting point, to explore what others have done and what kind of potential setup they have used.
But the BRDF, I've read some literature about the BRDF measurements,
If you talk about the color reference, you can define 45.0, that's my reference.
Would
then
give
you
a lot of idea, but without
angles.
That perspective, you
and
really
then
don't
basically
get
what you want to do is you want to test whether the existing color differences are applicable
reading
to BRDF. Isn't it that that is probably the context?
Yeah,
and then you can.
But like
you can check, just
first
pure
of all,
Euclidean distance. It's a little bit poor, and then you have 94
and it's like
2000.
You still have to find this question that you have.
These parameters that you can change. We talk about K constant parameters for textiles, for instance, or for the graphic industry. It is possible to adjust some of these parameters to make the color difference formula make it more applicable in relation to the visual difference. That's my point. Yeah. No, but two things: check the literature, the BRDF and the color difference, and catch up with Tom Sima.
Yes.
Send her an email what she could kind of offer or suggest or propose.
That would be good.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
A quick question.
Yeah.
Do you remember yesterday I asked you about the
HDR?
Yes, exactly. Should I just send you an email about that?
Yeah, I'm not remember that I have seen send it